morning. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue, Monday, April 1st. And there are no jokes this morning.
Just wait.
We have three bills on our agenda. I intend to take them in the order in which the agenda is printed. The final bill is listed as a work session. It's on here for the purpose of receiving additional information from Legislative Revenue Office for committee discussion and to cover anything else relevant to that bill, but I do not intend to take a vote on that bill today. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 3324. Mr. Allender.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3324 amends the state's gift law to exempt funds collected through third-party vendors who receive payments for electric vehicle charging services.
All right. We have two people signed up to testify. And there are no legislators in the room.
Correct.
This bill at the present time.
Correct.
I'd like to hear from Ann Smart and Miles Pengilly.
Hi, Rep. Nathanson and members of the committee. My name is Ann Smart, and I'm the Vice President of Policy for ChargePoint. We're the largest network of electric vehicle charging stations. For the past several months, we have been working with DAS and the Treasury Department to attempt to fix a recent interpretation of a challenge for complying with Oregon's public gift law. So ChargePoint and some of our competitors have sold charging stations, charging hardware that is owned by the state, in this case, DAS. These stations are networked to enable the state to operate the stations, manage energy, and collect a fee from drivers. Our business model and that of many of our competitors is to operate those network services, to manage the service and collect payment from the driver, and then remit it back to the state after a period of time. In the case where we are holding those funds from drivers and then remitting it back to the state, we have found under a recent interpretation of public gift law that that would be in violation. We think this interpretation has a sweeping impact across all public stations, both at the local, county, and state level, as well as the ability of DAS to actually charge any fee at a charging station. Charging fees is important to making sure that they're collecting revenue necessary to operate the stations and to make sure that drivers are moving their vehicles when they're done charging. We've identified the solution as outlined in HB 3324 by simply amending the public gift law to allow third-party electric vehicle networked payment services. We urge your support for HB 3324.
Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Marsh and Finley, members of the committee, Miles Pengilly testifying for Forth in support of House Bill 3324. Forth is a nonprofit trade association that advocates for the advancement of electric, hydrogen smart, connected, and autonomous mobility. We have over 160 members representing auto manufacturers, electric vehicle charging suppliers, industry partners, utilities, local governments, and nonprofits. We're testifying in support of House Bill 3324. It's really just a simple technical fix bill that creates an exemption to Oregon's public gift law for electric vehicle charging vendors, which allows them to, as Ann explained, to temporarily hold the funds that they collect at publicly owned charging stations and then remit those fees to the state at a later date. That helps to ensure that drivers basically have the same charging experience at any charging station across a vendor's network nationwide. Electrifying our transportation sector is a crucial component in preparing for Oregon's transportation future and for meeting our state's climate goals. And we see House Bill 3324 as a simple bill that will help facilitate that transition.
Thank you. I would like... like you, Ann, to clarify something for me. I completely get it that if there's a violation, you of public gift law. You want to fix it because this is an important service, and you're making the case why it's important, an important service, and we need to fix it. But that's like point A and point C. I need to understand what is point B. What is it about the gift law? There's no gifts here. So what is it that makes this subject to the public gift law that is a problem?
Thanks, Chair Nathanson. So the issue is that when we take the money from the driver through our charging network, so let's say DAS owns a station and they want to charge a per kilowatt hour fee, a driver goes up to that station, they have a charge point account, we collect the money from the driver and then remit it back to the state. The process of us collecting money from the driver, holding it in our own account, and then providing it back to the state in that order is considered a public gift. We have found that there, we've provided information over to DAS and the Treasury to try to figure out how to circumvent all of those different processes, but the act of us being a charging network with our own billing practices and our own accounting purposes, that violates us holding the money at any point in time. It looks like the only way for DAS to do this otherwise would be to collect the money directly on site from the driver, or potentially whatever Treasury comes up with. We haven't yet found a solution. But this applies to just the fact that we have a charging network that collects money from the drivers and holds it in accounts before remitting it back to the state.
So welcome to the 21st century, and we need to update our statutes. Mm-hmm. Okay. Questions from the committee?
You took my question.
But I normally let you have like 11
you.
Or 12 for witness.
Jokes.
Anything else? Thank you for being
this
here.
This is just really dumb.
That might have been picked up on the microphone.
Oh, gosh.
Thank you. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 3324. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 3357.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3357, we didn't have anyone signed up yet, although we are expecting Representative Helt to be coming down shortly. So I would actually call your attention to just explain what it is that the bill's doing. In the meeting materials on OLIS, there is the SMS. But it's probably easier. Actually, I have a different document just called House Bill 3357 Description, and I'll just walk through that really briefly because I think that sets up kind of the description of the credit better than the SMS, which is a bit wordy. But so the credit that's being discussed in House Bill 3357 is the Working Family Household Independent Care Expenses Credit. So this is a personal income tax credit that exists right now on the books today. It is a refundable credit. And the general idea of the credit is it's generally going to be for lower income individuals, and it's providing a credit for as a percentage of the employment related expenses for the taxpayer. So the best example of that is probably childcare, and this is for a taxpayer for if they're working, looking for work, or attending school. So the document you see in OLIS, again, the credit itself is fairly simple. The way it's set up is it's a credit percentage times the employment related expenses. So if we scroll down to page 2 just real quickly, the credit percentage is in statute, and it's really a function of the income of the taxpayer and then the age of the qualifying individual. So if you have a younger, again, working with the example of a child, if you have a younger child at home, you can get a higher credit percentage, which means your credit equals a higher percentage of those dependent care expenses. So that's the way that the credit itself functions in terms of qualifying. So going back up to page 1 on the two-pager in OLIS, is there are limits on the employment-related expenses with the definition. So it begins with definitions from the Internal Revenue Code for a similar credit that's available at the federal level of what is an employment-related expense. And again, these are generally going to be allowing the taxpayer to seek employment, attend school, or look for employment. Again, the percentage, I went through that on how that functions, and then there are other limitations on the amount of overall expenses. So there is a limitation of, depending upon the qualifying individual. So you can't have expenses greater than $12,000 for one individual, or up to $24,000 if you have two or more individuals that you have those employment-related expenses. The changes in House Bill 3357 are expanding the provisions of the credit. This is primarily going to be for taxpayers that are students or part-time students, whether they're married or single, or filing single. And the way it's set up right now is to provide an imputed income for the student. If the student doesn't have income right now, that would allow them to essentially take the credit. So it's right now the language that's in the bill definitely puts forth a policy description of it. There's probably some language that need to be tightened in order to allow it to work as I'm describing it. But the general idea is just trying to set it up where this credit can be more likely to be used or used to a greater extent by students, or whether they're part-time or full-time students. And one of the things that is included in the measure is requiring the student to be a degree-seeking student that qualifies for student financial aid, but they don't necessarily have to take that financial aid, they just have to be qualified for it. And this would be applicable beginning tax year 2019, and then we do have an existing law sunset on this credit in 2021, so it will be one that would be reviewed in the following, the upcoming next long session.
Thank you. And you mentioned there is no one signed up to testify on the sign-up sheet.
Not right now.
Oh, okay. Representative Held is...
just here, and she just walked out.
Yes, Representative Marsh.
Thank you. Do we have any idea of the revenue impact on this?
Yeah, Rep. Marsh, a similar bill was discussed during the short 2018 session. Again, assuming the language gets tightened up a bit and some of the parameters, we were looking, in that case, was about $7 to $8 million per biennium. Again, we'll take a second look at this one with the way it's being drafted, but to give some sense of it, yeah.
Representative Held. Oh.
Can I ask one more question while she's coming up? Thank you, Madam Chair. And for Kyle. So wasn't this kind of created in the 2015 session? This was kind of we took a bunch of, I don't want to call them random, but a couple random tax credits and really did some work. I know Rep. Kenny Geyer was very involved. I think Representative Bueller at the time worked with her about putting this together and making it refundable. That's what this is building off of. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yes, Representative. It was, two credits were up for sunset review at the time, and they were merged together, and because they really did kind of address, or some of the same taxpayers were being helped by these two different credits. So it was an idea of putting them together as one credit and then trying to hit the same population in some ways.
And I think they were not refundable. It was not refundable before. We don't have to know that, but
sure.
Okay.
If they both were, yeah.
But it is now. This
yes.
is.
Yes,
great.
Is now.
Thank you.
Okay.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Marsh, and Representative Finley. My name is Sherry Held, and I represent Beautiful Bend. I am here to testify today for Bill 3357. One of the largest barriers in my area at Central Oregon Community College is childcare costs. We find this such a large barrier that we actually have an emergency fund for students that can apply to get up to $600 for childcare emergencies. And we have a waiting list that we are not serving all of the needs. The $600 only serves about a third of the cost that the students will experience. But this is a huge barrier for people with dependents at home, and it causes them to drop out. And so at my community college, we've actually met the needs through this emergency fund, but we can't meet all of the need. There is still, it only pays for a third of the childcare, and we have a waiting list. But it is so important. In Central Oregon, we're in a childcare desert, and childcare is just absolutely impossible to find. And any way that we can help students that are trying to get ahead and finish their degrees and take barriers out, I believe that we should. We know that if people go on to community college, they'll have more access to jobs. It will help with their household budgets in the future, possibly taking them off of assistance in the future. And it is so important in Central Oregon, and I can't stress that enough. And so that's why I'm excited to bring this bill forward for your consideration today. I did want to talk about another regional example. While this is not a tax credit, other efforts have been introduced to help couples and families to higher education programs to earn degrees or certificates. One example is in Tacoma, where the Education Access Incentive was paired with a housing investment as a way to assess the impact on outcomes on parents and their students enrolled in elementary school. The initiative of the Tacoma Housing Project is 6 years at work, and it's now seeing positive results. I believe that we can also see positive results in our states for our working and college-attending parents and dependents. So thanks for your consideration today, and I urge an aye vote.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Marsh and Findlay. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Jason Trombley, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Office of Representative Kenny Geyer. I know she couldn't be here today, but I know she's feverishly responding to Facebook posts and everyone's tweets wishing her well, and I know she's eager to get back into the building. So I'm here to speak in support of House Bill 3357. This bill is important for the representative in part because this came about after listening to students who were enrolled in Portland Community College, specifically the Southeast Campus, which is located in the heart of the district. This bill came of importance because what we know is that about 50% of students enrolled in Portland Community College are part-time students. A number of them are first-generation immigrants who are working hard to attain college degrees and access the job opportunities that the state is continuing to invest in. But one of the barriers continues to be, is given the current housing market, as well as employment opportunities and cost of living, that is increasing on everyone's monthly household budgets. And so one of the things that is really important here, especially as we're working to improve access to opportunities for all families, is to really taking a look at the costs imposed on every family going forward. And one of the important benefits of this particular tax credit is that it would alleviate household costs for families and actually allow families to both enroll in colleges, complete their degrees, but also maintain access to the housing in which they're living or gain access to stronger housing in the future. So with that, it's a pleasure to speak on behalf of the representative, and I hope you'll consider supporting this bill.
Questions?
Representative Marsh took my question, so.
I will ask one. We don't have current final revenue impact statement, but maybe something in the ballpark. This is an expansion of the current assistance that we provide. As you all well know, and as everyone understands in the building, we're oversubscribed for suggestions for tax credits.
Mm-hmm.
If there was an interest in looking at this because it's very useful to help keep people in school and allow them to finish, but if there weren't enough money in the tax credit budget, is there a particular direction in which you would you have thought about narrowing the scope of this, or is it does the bill represent this is the way it needs to be, and because of the way the concept is developed, it can't be pared back or narrowed?
Thank you, Chair Nathanson, for your question. One, I would hope that when we're looking at the tax credits, because I know that there are a lot of them, that we look at the return on investment. This particularly, I believe, is a huge return on investment. One, because we're investing in people that are investing in themselves. And so to get people to finish school and get off of public assistance would be really helpful to our state system. I believe that if we can get people and help them to graduation and get to better jobs and better income, we will definitely improve the outcomes that we have as a state. And so I think the return on investment is huge, and so I would hope that that would be a fact considered. Paring it down or moving it into a different type of subsidy would be open to, because the need is so great that we are finding that this is a huge barrier. It's a large enough barrier that my community college, on its minimal budgets, is assisting 23 students with $600 tax credits and at a third of the cost, and is turning away other people. And they're doing this while their, you know, incomes are, the income from the state has dropped, while tuition has been raised, and they're trying to keep it at as low a cost as possible. But they're doing it because they know that this is a huge barrier, and we have to change the conversation around this for these students to make sure that they're able to attend school and complete school and be able to be productive in our society. And so I hope all those factors will be considered, but I would be open to conversations, as well as I'm sure Representative Alyssa Kinnegar would be. And I'm proud to be here on her behalf as well, because she cannot. So
thank you for your response. Any other questions? And no one else had.
I just want to reemphasize that the fiscal is pretty critical before we can move on. But I appreciate your question, and the return on investments is a huge thing. So that somehow, if we could figure out how to quantify that somewhat, it would make it an easier decision later on. But we do have a substantially smaller tax credit budget than in the past. So
it has been a challenge for me for many years to figure out a way to express in our official documents and in our system where our revenue and fiscal offices report to us, because often the report is geared toward one particular event or in one particular biennium and doesn't take into account what happens in the next biennium and biennia after that. And it also often addresses what happens in one area of the budget, like revenue and on the revenue side, but not the cost side. So you can't, there isn't an official way to express cost avoidance, for example, or sometimes direct cost savings. So that's always been a challenge in the way the way materials are prepared for us to see real specifically an economic impact in a more holistic way.
Chair Nathanson, if I may add one more point for the record. On the first page of the letter that Portland Community College submitted to OLIS over the weekend, I do want to acknowledge one graph in terms of the immediate impact for their students, where it states, at Portland Community College, 58% of the students are part-time. They're working 2 and 3 jobs to keep their head above water and go to school. The average graduating class at PCC is 45% first-generation students. 30% of our students that had or are about to have children. What's worse is that 13% of our students don't know where they will lay their head at night, and 66% are experiencing food security. So I think looking at both the, if you're looking at the immediate impact over the immediate biennium, there are some immediate kind of statistics that you can take a look at in terms of to what percentage students will actually attain, you know, more housing stability, what percent of students have access to food, particularly with their statistics, but also pairing that with the long-term potential gain that Representative Helt has identified.
Very helpful, thank you. Anything else? And no one else signed up to testify, so I am closing the public hearing on House Bill 3357. I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2978.
Okay, Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2978, just as a reminder, this was a credit for shoreline rehabilitation projects. We do have a -1 amendment, but I'd actually take a second before getting into that. There were some questions during the public hearing that LRO was asked to respond to, so I do have responses to those, and they're up in OLIS. They're just a one-page document there that's response to committee questions. But even before I get into that, just to provide a little background, a little context, In the background of the SMS, it did include some information on the number of short line rail lines. There was the number that was bounced around at the public hearing was 17 or 18. There's actually identified 21 total from Department of Transportation, although some of these can be terminal rail lines, which are less than a mile in length, so pretty small. But so there's 21 in total, and just to give you some sense, that five of these are publicly owned. So some of the testimony that was received in the public hearing related to Port of Coos Bay's ownership of one of these. But most of them are privately owned, but five of these are publicly owned. It could be from a port, a city, or a county government owns some of these. And then in terms of just the rehabilitation, the costs that are out there, there was a study done by Department of Transportation in 2010, updated in 2014, where some of these numbers were provided. And I did include the output or the final recommendation from the Oregon Rail Funding Task Force. This was in 2011 and followed up on the first study put out by Department of Transportation. But the costs for rehabilitation of these short lines can range pretty drastically from $325 million or so to $2.1 billion. And that really depends upon what the rehabilitation project is or what it would be. And part of that is identifying bridges that are in need of perhaps some rehabilitation in some way, or you could also just replace the bridge if you wanted a longer term use out of it. So that's part of the range of as little, so to speak, of $325 million all the way up to that $2.1 billion figure. Again, that's replacing bridges and doing more, maybe replacing tunnels rather than just reinforcing them. But so that's the context of costs. In terms of the response to the committee questions, so again, there's a document on OLIS. The first one was about the federal railroad tax credits. This was discussed in the public hearing. Again, there is a federal short line railroad tax credit, or there was. It's not effective right now, but it was similar to the way Oregon's, the one that's being discussed here in 2978, was in many ways built upon the federal credit that's, as of right now, sunset. But that's a 50% credit related to the rehabilitation costs. And again, it's also for the short line railroads. this federal credit has been in place from 2005 to 2017. So it has sunset at the federal level, but there is legislation on both the House side and the Senate side at the federal level that would retroactively make the credit available again, picking up beginning with 2018. And with no sunset date going forward. So there has been sunset dates in previous federal credit law. This one would bring back the federal credit and leave it in place without a sunset. And again, that's been reintroduced on both the House and the Senate side. So those, we'll see where that goes forward at the federal level. The second question was in terms of transferability of a credit. Again, transferability is a policy option that is used in credits. This is primarily going to be in instances where you have an entity that would receive the credit but has no tax liability. So that could be an example of the short lines, that would be a government owner. You can give them a tax credit, but they have no tax liability, so that tax credit has no effect on them. There's no way to reimburse them for costs. So what transferability does is it allows the entity that receives the credit to then sell it to another entity or a taxpayer that has tax liability. So the example would be if you had a $10,000 credit, you're maybe a port district, you could then sell that credit for, say, $8,500. You now have $8,500 to reimburse you for those costs, and the taxpayer that purchased it bought a credit worth $10,000 for $8,500. So the taxpayer that purchased it would benefit by $1,500. But that's the general framework, the transferability. There is some language in the Dash 1 amendment that does tie this with ongoing discussions and a bill that is in this committee right now from the Department of Revenue related to making transferability of tax credits more uniform. So just to kind of put a plug in there. in terms of the last question was related to direct appropriation comparison. So I just have a kind of a chart there with two boxes just to kind of give the idea and the discussion that often comes up between a tax credit or a direct appropriation. In this case, for rail funding, there are examples of direct appropriations. That is something that is ongoing, whether it's federal grants. Connect Oregon also provided grants to whether they're the short line rail as well. But generally what comes up is you have administration, whether or not it's more straightforward to use the tax system, use a tax credit, or directly appropriate. The timing of applicability, again, tax credits generally get a six-year review, so that's a six-year process that's usually in place with a tax credit as compared to a direct appropriation, which may come up every single biennium. So there's differences there. The ability to claim the credit, of course, that's where the transferability comes in, where if a taxpayer doesn't have that ability to claim, then there needs to be something put in place to allow that entity to receive some benefit from the credit. And then the last thing that comes up quite a bit is just the timing of it. So again, a tax credit, again, that's something that happens in when you file your taxes for the most part, where a direct appropriation could happen at a different stage, where you could get the funding before the rehabilitation project is done or at some point during the year, if it's the idea is to get the funding out to the entity doing the rehabilitation on the short line more quickly. But those are just things to keep in mind in terms of a tax credit and a direct appropriation. In terms of the Dash 1 amendment, there are it's a few changes in there. The first one is, in just the first few lines of the Dash 1, is disallowing, in some way, disallowing the use of Oregon's credit if a federal credit is claimed for those same rehabilitation costs. So if the federal credit were to come back and, say, a railroad takes the federal credit, they then couldn't use those same rehabilitation costs to qualify for Oregon's credit. So it would avoid taking both credits for the same rehabilitation cost. Now, you could choose to take the Oregon credit instead, but that would be up to the taxpayer or the railroad to choose between those two. The other changes related to the certification. So the certification of the credit in this case would now be with Department of Transportation rather than Department of Revenue, as in the introduced version. There is language in there that's somewhat standard in the case of certification is done by, in this case, Department of Transportation, and they notify Department of Revenue of who is qualifying for the credit. There is rulemaking authority provided to Department of Transportation, Department of Revenue. The language related to the transferability of the credit has been replaced with the language more in line with the standard uniform language that's being discussed in other bills before this committee. And then there is also language that's put in place for conditions and procedures related to instances of fraud, where the idea is you can claw back a credit that's been certified or a credit amount that went to, say, an entity or a railroad in this case that didn't live up to, so to speak, their requirements. So that language has been included as well. And again, this does apply to tax years 2020 through 2025. So it is set up to have the standard six-year credit language. And just as the last point is, there is an overall limit on these credits for the certification for the year. Right now, that is still left blank in this bill. So that has not been specified what the annual limit is.
Thank you. Representative Reschke.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and Kyle. Quick question for Kyle is, in your Dash 1 staff measure summary, at the end of the paragraph, it says, limits total amount of potential tax credits at time of preliminary certification and no more than blank dollars for any biennium. I was wondering if we had a number to put in there or not, or am I looking at an older version?
No, Representative, it is still a blank in the Dash 1 as well. So that is the one piece that's still left unspecified at this time.
Okay, so we don't know what the limit is. When would we know that?
You would have to fill that in before it would certainly, the bill would move out of this committee. So okay. I think at this point the Dash 1 was still following up on the continued discussion. That was part of the public hearing, was fixing some of the things that were brought up and then revisiting.
And then a follow-up, Madam Chair?
Yes.
And just a comment. It sounds like the certification process is now at ODOT, and then DOR will issue the credit. And I'm on this bill, but it gives me just a little pause because we had the same model for the gigabit exception where the PUC gave the authorization for the exemption and then DOR denied it in some cases. And so I want to make sure that linkage is really tight as opposed to one agency saying, yeah, this qualifies, you do the work, you apply for the credit, and then find out, oh, no, it doesn't.
Representative Marsh.
Thank you. Thank you, Kyle. I have a few questions about the federal tax credit. Do we know what amount is specified in the federal tax credit the bills that have been submitted?
Yeah, Representative Marsh, it's The same as what we have here in Oregon. It's the 50%, and then also that other limitation potentially of the $3,500 multiplied by the sum of the rail line. So it's unchanged from what the existing credit was at the federal level before it sunset. So it's just a simple sunset elimination, I guess. It extends it without a sunset. So there's no policy change at the federal level.
So two more questions about that. One is, I'm wondering if we could check with our federal representatives and see how that bill is moving through. I think it'd be helpful to know whether there's a sense that it's likely to be acted upon. And secondly, I'm wondering if we could rewrite this bill so that if the federal tax credit passes, that the state tax credit is not available. I don't want people choosing between the Fed and the state if they have an option to take the Fed. We want them to take the Fed.
Yeah, Representative Marsh, we can follow up. And I believe one of the bills is, I want to say it's Rep. DeFazio is introducing it, mm-hmm. but it is from Oregon's delegation. I believe last federal session it did pass out of, I want to say the House, but it didn't get out of the second chamber. So there has been some traction with the bill.
And if I could ask one more question. Yes. Thank you. And I'm assuming that federal tax credit, though, is not useful to the publicly owned short lines. Is that correct?
I would have to follow up on that up there. I didn't see any transferability in the language, but it could be buried in rules. So I can follow up to see if there's something at the federal level that would, get that to them.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kyle, this might be for you. Kyle, I have one question. Is there ability to stack these? Can a short line have a projects that they complete? They're expanding or they're moving the credits over a 5-year period. Can they get another one? And have multiple credits going? And I'm on the bill as well, because I have a short line in there. It's a great thing, but I'm just nervous about stacking and the total impacts.
Yeah, Representative Finley, the way that it was, the sum of the language was changed to focus on the rehabilitation that was done during that tax year. So even if it's, you think if it's one project, so to speak, but it's done over 2 years, you could take, you'd get two different credits for those years. But yes, you could do something over on this part of the line and then the next year do something on another unrelated part of the line. And yeah, you could be getting different tax credits in every year, so to speak, if you're constantly doing that.
Thank you.
Other questions or discussion? Legislative Revenue Office will be getting back to us with answers to those questions with a potential revenue impact statement. And we'll see where that information leads. Determine committee interest in whether there's interest in another work session. Anything else? I'm closing the work session on House Bill 2978. There is no other business before us. We're adjourned.